Well, good morning, Bellevue, here in the church and those gathered around the city. I have to say it's great to have an audience. My office wall is beginning to look rather tedious, and so it's great. Thank you for coming. I've spoken to smaller audiences than this, so size is not everything in God's kingdom, so thank you for coming. As Colin said, our topic this morning is money, and it's interesting and fairly powerful stuff is money. Apparently it talks. I don't know if you've ever had a £5 note. You can't get £5 notes now, can you? I don't know. Talking to you, but there you go, it talks. It'll burn a hole in your pocket if that's where you keep it. And apparently it also makes the world go round. However, it doesn't grow in trees. Some of us would say that's unfortunate. And it certainly can't buy you love, according to one even more ancient popular music group than the one Colin has inflicted on us this morning. But it's one of these topics, isn't it, that in reality we don't like really to talk about. It's rather vulgar to talk about money, but if we're honest, it does dominate our life and our thinking, usually because we think we haven't got enough of this stuff, and a little bit more wouldn't go amiss. It was probably inevitable, however, that the writer of Ecclesiastes would get round to the topic. He's been ransacking the experiences of life, as he describes it, as living under the sun, his day-to-day existence. He's been trying to find things that have meaning and substance on which you can really build your life. And all he's come across so far are things that he describes as chasing the wind, vapor. The minute you've got them, they've disappeared. You certainly can't rely on them. And so the question he's posing for us this morning is, can that meaning and substance in life be found in money? Or can we be confident in life if our bank balance is healthy? Now, I would never dream of speaking for all preachers, but I don't think money is necessarily a favourite topic of preachers, unless you're the Reverend Benny Hinn in America, in which case that's all he talks about. And that's not a recommendation, by the way, for you to go and look him up on YouTube and listen to the man. It's complete nonsense, but there you are. Anne-Marie pointed out to me, helpfully, I thought, that this is the third time I've had to speak and touch on the subject of money in recent days, so maybe the Lord's saying something to me about it. But we're going to repeat maybe some of the things that we looked at or thought about, at least when we looked at the book of James. I think James knew Ecclesiastes quite well. It does go without saying, however, that as with everything else in your life as a Christian, money and what we do with it needs to be developed in line with what the Bible teaches. We need a theology of money, if you want a phrase. And helpfully, the Bible, and indeed the Lord Jesus, says a great deal about money. And our writer this morning is going to help us a little bit, but remember, his perspective, his teaching is taken from his own experience, from his day-to-day life. And so when he eventually concludes that the real answer is found in God, we don't then get a detailed exposition of what he means by that. And so we need to explore some wider scriptures to perhaps understand it better. But it is worth saying, as I said before, that nowhere does the Bible condemn money or being wealthy. And that should be a relief for all of us, actually, living in the West, perhaps for some a greater relief than for others. The Bible teaches that money is a good gift from God, but it's also a major temptation, and it can be a terrible master. The version that I've been studying it from, the English study version, talks about God giving us the power to enjoy wealth. The word is mastery. Money can be a terrible master. Why? Because it promises things to us that ultimately it can never deliver. If you want comfort in life, you need money. If you want security in life, you need money. If you want to have fun, find fulfillment in life, be powerful, you need money. Money seems to be the universal key that unlocks all the doors to happiness. And that, of course, is the lie that every generation believes. Nathan, stick that picture back up that was up at the beginning. I know Christian likes his art, so I thought I'd go a little bit highbrow this morning. This is by the Renaissance artist Quentin Massies, who I'd never heard of. Never heard of. He's Belgian. And he painted this, the moneylender's wife. He lived in Antwerp when he painted it. And at the time, Antwerp was the money capital of Europe. And in the picture, he shows rather powerfully how the attention of the wife is being drawn from her scriptures, her holy book perhaps, to look at her husband as he does the far more important job of counting the money, weighing up, have they got enough? And I think the artist very powerfully captures that subtle underlying draw on all of our hearts, perhaps. That's the height of the culture this morning, I have to say. So thanks, Nathan. Back to our writer, however, in the book of Ecclesiastes. And as I said, perhaps from his own experience as king or as someone who looked at what the king was doing or who simply knew people in his circle of friends, he concludes some things about money that are helpful to us as we live today in our culture, dominated and obsessed with money. And he confirms his belief that ultimately money is never going to be the source of meaning and of value in life. He says four things about money, which are right bang up to date, actually, and quite helpful to us. He firstly says in verse 10 that money, or the love of money, doesn't bring satisfaction. He who loves money will not be satisfied, nor he who loves wealth with his income. Back in 1954, a book was published entitled Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic. The author cleverly blended these two words, affluence and influenza, which was the pandemic of that day, and created the term affluenza, which he described as a painful, contagious, socially transmitted condition of overload, debt, anxiety, and waste, resulting from the dogged pursuit of more. 1954, post-war America. Same condition today, really, isn't it? No cure has been found 70 years on. That love of money, that deep desire to have and to own, is ultimately not satisfying. The Apostle Paul, of course, echoed these words, didn't he? In writing to Timothy, he said, look, the love of money is a root, not the root, but a root, one of them, of all kinds of evil. Through the craving for this, says Paul, people have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. Love, you see, is that strongest of emotions that God has put in our heart, specifically reserved for love of him. And that love for him should be all-consuming. The Bible is clear that all other loves are forms of idolatry. Derek Kidner, in his commentary on Ecclesiastes, describes a love of money as an addiction. And he writes, if anything is worse than the addiction money brings, it is the emptiness it leaves. Man with eternity in his heart needs better nourishment than this. So it doesn't bring satisfaction. Then in verse 11, he concludes, money attracts people to spend it for you. When goods increase, he says, they increase who eat them. Possessions don't seem to come on their own. They attract people who want to get their hands, he says, on your money. Whether it's relatives wanting a handout, or friends you didn't know you had until they discovered you had something that made it worth being their friend, or simply the vast array of people that you need to run your life when you're rich. That big house with 10 bathrooms needs cleaned. You're too busy to clean it. Your Olympic-sized swimming pool needs emptied and refilled. Your garden tended, your many cars cleaned and serviced. You probably need an accountant or a banker to look after it all for you. The point he's making here, and probably doesn't apply to us, I suspect, you think money's yours, think again. There's always someone wanting to spend it for you. Then he says in verse 12, money is going to give you a sleepless night. He says, sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let them sleep. He's musing to himself here that, well, if he was just a laborer and didn't have a lot, he would sleep a whole lot easier in his bed. But with wealth comes sleepless nights. Whether it's because you've been to lots of parties with your fellow rich people and you've eaten lots, drunk too much, and you've got indigestion now, or whether you're simply up all night worrying about that big decision you've got to take because you're powerful. Either way, you've got a sleepless night. And I guess the point he's making here is that having loads of money, having things, doesn't automatically lead to a life of no worry. Think of what happens when your car breaks down. Your whole world suddenly takes on a different perspective, doesn't it? Or the dishwasher stops working and you've forgotten how to fill a sink, and all of a sudden, life's not as good as it was when you woke up. Sleepless nights. And then in verses 13 through 16, he points out actually that having money doesn't bring any certainty in life. And he paints for us some pictures, a picture of a hoarder who's building his life on what he has, who seems to take a risk because he thinks he needs more, maybe puts it all on red and it comes up black, and he loses it all and he hasn't even got anything left to leave to his only son. Or in the opening verses of chapter 6, the stranger's enjoying the wealth that this man once had. Maybe the stranger's a thief who's stolen it, or he's the one who won the bet at the casino and who gained from his losses. Chapter 6 is a really dark passage. It seems to tell us of a man who God has given power to gain wealth, but he doesn't have mastery over it. He hasn't been given the gift of enjoying his wealth. And that even if he lives a long and a healthy life and he has loads of kids, surely happiness follows. No is the answer. The writer's telling us there's no joy to be had here. The lover of money seems now to have empty pockets, no real friends, and a life that is unsatisfied and depressed. Indeed, perhaps he's a shade angry at the circumstances. But he also paints, of course, the greatest uncertainty that is caused by the greatest certainty of all, death itself. Verse 15 maybe reminds you of what Job said. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and he shall take nothing for his toil. And we know the reality of the point he makes, don't we? We may choose not to think about it, but it's real. John Stott says, life is a pilgrimage between two periods of nakedness. Rather stark but true. Well, in amongst what he has said in these four things, the teacher asks us a couple of questions, and he leaves a third question unasked, but it's a question that does hang over the whole passage. The first question he asks in verse 11 is, what advantage does the rich person have other than to look at what he has, to feast his eyes on it? Now, our history, both ancient and modern, is replete with examples of the rich people who stored up wealth, maybe looked at it every day, feasting their eyes on it. I was watching an old episode of Top Gear the other week. It's the one with Chris Evans, I don't know what he does now. He was a radio presenter for a while. He has, I think at the last count, 27 Ferraris. And he's painted them all white. Some of them worth millions of pounds. And he sits them all in a garage and even has a piano that plays music to them automatically. And they never really go anywhere. Nobody sees them but him. It's madness, isn't it? What advantage, a writer asks. And then in verse 16, he says, well, what gain is there, actually? You toil for something that you can never have. You're looking for satisfaction, and it doesn't happen. What you get, he says, is vexation, sickness, and anger. The actor Jim Carrey said, I think everyone should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that that's not the answer. Now, maybe we feel that's an excessively bleak view of things. And we're saying to ourselves, well, I'm not fantastically wealthy and, you know, I manage to get along okay in life. I do my work day to day, as he would describe it, toiling under the sun. I don't have that sense of futility that he expresses. But I guess, however, we also know that even in our better moments, we do feel sometimes enslaved by our possessions, don't we? And perhaps at our worst moments, we feel it, we find it impossible to quell that instinct to acquire and own things for their own sake. We find ourselves saying, don't we, if only I had. And so the third question, which our teacher doesn't explicitly ask, but it hangs over the whole passage, is how does a godly man live in a world which is dominated by money and the pursuit of wealth? Or we might phrase it, how do we as Christians deal with money? It's a key question for us as we live, as we thought previously, in exile in this world, in a culture that is not the culture that we would want to be part of. Well, in verses 18 to 20, he scratches the surface of the answer as he points his readers inevitably to a deeper understanding of where meaning under the sun is to be found, and specifically how we find harmony between riches and a life lived in relationship with God. Now, he doesn't give us this full and detailed answer that some of us might have liked him to, but he does give us a massive clue as he writes in verse 18 of God as the giver of life, in verse 19, as God is the giver of wealth and possessions, and as that God-given gift of power, of mastery, of being able not to be mastered by your money, but to be master of what God has given you. To enjoy such things, he says, so that our days are satisfied, and in a wonderful turn of phrase, occupied with the joy of God in our heart. And so as I thought of these things, I reflected on maybe four things that we might take as application this morning, and they're not brand new. The first thing is, I think we do need to recognize who gives us things. The teacher says clearly God is the giver. In his goodness, he gives us things richly to enjoy, and that includes money. But he's given it to us as a trust. It's not ours to keep permanently, to do with as we wish. And to convey that reality, the Bible uses the concept of a steward, doesn't it? Someone who's responsible for money, able to spend it, but does so on behalf of their master. And that concept is so crucial that Jesus uses it as a metaphor for all of Christian discipleship. He compares God to a master who entrusts varying sums of money to servants, goes away for a time, and expects them to be wise with their responsibilities till he returns. And in this case, they're to invest the money and make a profit. Now, Jesus' point in that parable is far broader than simply what we should do with our money, but that's certainly one aspect of the message. I think we need to remember day to day, God is the giver of all that we have. And therefore, secondly, we need to be thankful for what we have. I wonder how thankful are we? We have food to eat, we have clothes to wear, we have money to pay the bills. I wonder if we need to cultivate a habit of thankfulness that says to God, thank you for every bite, every shirt, every penny we have. And the Apostle Paul repeatedly in his letters in the New Testament, as well as encouraging people to pray, encouraging people to rejoice, always encouraged them to be thankful in all circumstances. I think maybe we need to remember to be thankful. And then thirdly, we need to be generous with what we have. Because again, over and over, the Bible commands and commends generosity. Christians are directly instructed to be generous. Again, Paul writing to Timothy, passing on his pastoral advice, a very clear message. Command them to be good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous, to be willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves. And so a biblical attitude towards money is not how much can I get, but how much can I give. And Jesus teaches what our teacher here teaches, that earthly wealth has no eternal value. But when you use your money to serve others and glorify God, you're investing in eternal treasures. It's the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount. So our desire to have should never surpass our desire to give. A pursuit of material goods must always take a permanent back seat to generosity. Remembering we are able to give freely because we can rest in the knowledge that God will provide for us, perhaps even through the generosity of others, of course. So we need to be generous with what we have. And then finally, and Colin mentioned this in his introduction, and Adrian covered it a couple of weeks ago, we need to be content with what God gives. Maybe this is the hardest Christian virtue of all. In the words of the teacher, he says, verse 19, we need to simply accept our lot. Accept what God has given to us, whether that's a lot or not very much. Paul says godliness with contentment is great gain. It never came naturally, of course, to the Apostle Paul, contentment. He tells us in the letter to the Philippians, he had to learn to be content. It took hard work, a constant attention to the attitude of heart that says simply, what God has given me is enough. If I need more, he will give it. I need less. I must give it. The Puritan writer Jeremiah Burroughs wrote a great little book. You can download it off the internet as a JPEG. I doubt you'll find it in publication, but it's on the web. He called it The Rare Jewel of Christian contentment. And in it, he says this: Christian contentment is that sweet, inward, quiet, gracious frame of mind which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. Or in the words of our teacher this morning, may God keep us occupied with joy in our hearts, so that the lure, if you like, of this world's gifts pale in comparison with the riches of all that God has given us in Christ and will give us in our future inheritance. My reading this morning from the Encounter with God notes was Psalm 119. Fortunately, not the whole psalm, but a section of it, and verses 36 and 39 stood out to me, I guess, with the message in mind. And maybe this is a prayer for us for the week ahead. The psalmist says this: incline my heart to your testimonies and not to selfish gain. Turn my eyes from looking at worthless things and give me life in your ways. May God bless his word to us this morning. Thank you, Colin.